This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Today, we're taking on what a lot of people argue is the single most important academic paper of the entire 20th century.
It's a big claim, but it's probably true.
It is. We're talking about Claude E. Shannon's 1948 masterpiece, A Mathematical Theory of Communication. It's basically the mathematical blueprint for, well, for everything you're doing right now, every digital interaction.
It's so much more than just a technical paper, though. It's really a philosophical reset. Shannon gave us the mathematical grammar for the information age. I mean, this is the bedrock theory that explains how your phone compresses a video.
How data gets across the internet.
How it navigates the internet, and even how scientists figure out the absolute limits of computation itself. It's foundational.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack those core ideas. We're talking entropy, channel capacity, and the two big fundamental theorems. And our sources for this, well, they don't just cover Shannon's original work.
No, we're also looking at how his theory is being stretched today. I mean, pushed into these incredibly complex new frontiers.
Like systems biology, of all things.
And the really big one, the challenge of mathematically modeling human meaning, you know, semantic communication.
Right. But to get there, you have to understand the conceptual leap he made first. And that really was his genius. You have to picture what communication engineering was like before 1948.
Oh, it was a totally different world.
Yeah.
Engineers were fighting these very specific, very physical problems. They were worried about voltage drops in a specific cable.
The bandwidth of a radio frequency.
Exactly. Or, you know, what's the best material for this copper wire? Shannon just, he threw all of that out.
He just jettisoned it. He moved the entire problem from electrical engineering into, well, into the abstract world of probability and statistics.
Precisely. And by doing that, he created a model that is completely medium agnostic. That was the goal.
Meaning it works for anything.
It applies just as well to a 19th century telegraph wire as it does to a modern fiber optic cable, a 5G signal, or, and this is the crazy part, the chemical signals inside a living nerve cell. He found this universal language by just stripping away all the physical noise and focusing only on one thing, the uncertainty in selecting the message.
And that leads us right to his definition of information, which is so counterintuitive for most people. He defined the basic problem of communication as, and I'm quoting here, reproducing at one point, either exactly or approximately, a message selected at another point.
And that definition, it dictates everything that follows. The core insight is that information is not defined by what it means. Not at all. It's purely about resolving uncertainty.
Doesn't matter what you're sending.
Doesn't matter if it's the proof of Fermat's last theorem or just a random string of coin flips. If they have the same statistical properties, the same probabilities, they contain the exact same amount of measurable information. The meaning is completely irrelevant to the engineering task.
Let's start right there then. This idea of a non-semantic revolution. Shannon explicitly states that the meaning, the semantic content, is, quote, irrelevant to its transmission. That feels so wrong when we talk about human communication. Why was that so important?
It was absolutely crucial, because before him, every attempt to quantify communication was, well, it was trapped in the physical world. I mean, think way back to the start of telecommunications. You have Samuel Morse in the 1830s.
Right.
He's dealing with the very practical limits of sending electrical pulses down a wire. And then later, you get figures like William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, and Oliver Heaviside.
And they were working on the transatlantic cables, right, fighting the physics of the ocean floor.
Exactly. They were battling the material properties of the cable itself. I mean, they were using very sophisticated math for the time, like Fourier analysis, but their goal was always to solve a physical problem. How do we stop this electrical signal from decaying?
How do we manage the inductance?
Right. They were fundamentally tethered to copper, so their findings for a cable couldn't just be applied to, say, radio waves.
Because radio waves have totally different physical problems.
Yeah, a completely different set of problems. Shannon realized that if you just treat the signal as a sequence of choices, a sequence of symbols, and you can assign probabilities to those choices, you completely decouple the message from the medium it's traveling on.
So by throwing out the meaning, he achieved universal applicability. The physics of the channel became secondary.
It became just one variable in a much bigger probabilistic model. By focusing only on the message as a sequence with, you know, measurable statistical properties, how often does E follow T in English? What's the probability of this voltage level? He created a quantifiable, rigorous metric for information.
And that metric holds true, whether the symbols are letters or zeros and ones or
firing neurons. It makes no difference to the math.
Okay, so if information isn't about meaning, how do we actually quantify it? This brings us to that inverse relationship you mentioned between probability and information. The idea of surprisal.
Surprisal is really the heart of it. Information in Shannon's universe is all about resolving uncertainty. So if an event is highly probable, let's say you get a long string of zeros and a file you already know is mostly zeros.
That's not surprising at all.
It's not surprising. It carries very, very low information content. You haven't learned much. The uncertainty you resolved was minimal.
But if, in that same file, you suddenly get a complex, unexpected sequence of ones,
then the information content spikes. An event that is highly unlikely, winning the lottery or seeing that complex sequence, that has high surprisal and therefore high information content. The more unexpected the message, the more information you gain by receiving it.
And he translated this into a mathematical formula of all 1 pec 1 b over, which uses a logarithm. That choice of a logarithm wasn't just random, was it?
Oh, not at all. That was a critically important choice. Using the logarithm, specifically base 2, is what ensures this really desirable property called additivity.
Additivity.
Yes. Without the logarithm, trying to combine the information from 2 separate independent events would be a mathematical mess.
Can you give us an analogy for that? Make it a bit more tangible.
Sure. Imagine you flip a fair coin. That's event A. And then you roll a fair 6-sided die. That's event B. The probability of getting heads, P of A, is 1/2.
Right.
The information you gain from that flip is log base 2 of 1 over 1/2, which is just 1. One bit of information.
Okay.
Now, the probability of rolling, say, a 4 on the die is 1/6. The information you gain from that is log base 2 of 6, which is about 2.58 bits.
So in probability, if we want to know the chance of both happening, flipping heads and rolling a 4, we multiply the probabilities. 1/2 times 1/6.
Exactly. 1/12. But in Shannon's information framework, because he used that logarithm, we don't have to multiply. We just add the information values.
So it's 1 bit plus 2.58 bits.
Right. 3.58 bits total. The logarithm transforms the messy product rule of probability into a simple, elegant sum rule for information. It makes all the calculations for designing systems so much easier.
And this whole framework is what gives us the fundamental unit of it all, the bit.
The bit. The binary digit. This is the point where communication theory and computation theory fuse together. It quantifies the simplest possible decision you can make, a choice between 2 equally likely outcomes, 0 or 1. Shannon's work provided the theoretical justification for why the digital revolution could even work.
And from this idea of surprisal, this information content of a single event, we get to the big one, Shannon entropy, with a capital H. The actual measure of uncertainty for a whole system.
Right. H is the expected value of that self-information. The easiest way to think about it is it's the weighted average of all the possible surprisals in your information source.
So not just one event, but the average of all possible events.
Exactly. It quantifies the average amount of uncertainty that is inherent in a source. So if you calculate the entropy of the English language, for example, what you're really finding is the average number of bits you would need to specify what the next letter is going to be, given the statistics of all the letters that came before it.
So if I have a source that's just spitting out completely random characters, A, B, C, D, with equal probability, its entropy would be maximal.
Maximal, because every single symbol is as surprising as it can possibly be. But on the other hand, if you have a source that just outputs the letter A 99% of the time,
then its entropy is incredibly low because there's no surprise.
Almost zero. Low entropy means high predictability, which means high redundancy, and very low average information content. High entropy means the opposite. Low predictability, high information content. And this single number, H, is what sets the absolute limit for data compression.
Before we get to that, we have to tell the story about how it got its name. The anecdote with John von Neumann. It just says so much about that whole era of science.
It's probably the most famous story in all of information theory, and for good reason. Shannon's formula for H, his uncertainty function, it turned out to have the exact same mathematical structure as the formula for entropy in statistical mechanics.
Which was first defined by J. Willard Gibbs, right? To measure disorder in a physical system, like gas molecules in a box.
Yes, the dispersion of energy states. Shannon was apparently struggling to find a name for his measure of uncertainty.
And he talked to von Neumann about it.
He did. And von Neumann, being von Neumann, immediately saw the mathematical parallel. And he reportedly gave Shannon two reasons to call it entropy. The first was the technical one. It acknowledges the connection to statistical mechanics.
And the second reason is the punchline.
The second reason is the brilliant, pragmatic part. Von Neumann basically told him, and I'm paraphrasing here, no one really knows what entropy is anyway, so in a debate, you will always have the advantage.
That's incredible. He was thinking about the rhetorical power of the word.
He was. He was essentially linking these two completely different fields, physics and communication, under this one powerful, mathematically consistent banner. He was saying, look, what you're quantifying is potential information, or you could say missing information.
And it doesn't matter if that missing information is about the speed of a molecule or the next symbol in a text message.
The underlying measure of uncertainty is the same. It was a stroke of genius. It just solidified the conceptual weight of what Shannon had discovered.
So Shannon's theory gives us these two absolute fundamental pillars that govern the entire digital world. Well, let's start with the first one, the one that really gives H its practical meaning, the source coding theorem. This is all about compression.
The source coding theorem, or the noiseless coding theorem, is the first pillar. It gives H its operational meaning. It establishes the absolute intrinsic limit of lossless data representation.
So this is the theoretical best you can ever do when compressing a file before you're forced to start losing information.
Exactly. And the theorem really has two parts. There's the impossibility part, which is kind of the bad news.
And the achievability part, the good news.
The impossibility part is very stern. It says it is mathematically impossible to compress a stream of data so that the code rate, that's the average number of bits you use per symbol, R, is less than the source entropy H.
You can't go below H.
You can't go below H without a virtual certainty of losing information. H is the theoretical floor. If your source has an entropy of, say, 3 bits per symbol, you must use at least 3 bits on average to represent it losslessly.
Okay, so that's the limit. And the achievability part, that's the challenge to engineers.
That's the part that says you can get there. It assures us that coding techniques exist that can get you arbitrarily close to that limit. R can approach H.
It doesn't tell you how to build the perfect compressor, though.
No, it just proves it's possible, which is huge. It means H becomes the ultimate yardstick. The gold standard.
So if I invent a new compression algorithm, I can measure its performance against the theoretical best, which is H.
Absolutely. If you calculate that a source has an entropy of 1.5 bits per symbol, but your fancy new algorithm is still using 2.5 bits per symbol to encode it, you know for a fact there is a 1-bit inefficiency in your design. There's room to improve.
And this is what led to real-world compression techniques, things like Huffman coding or Lempel-Ziv.
All of those are forms of what we call entropy coding. They are all practical attempts to get as close to that bound H as possible by intelligently exploiting the statistical redundancy in the source.
So how do they do that intuitively? How does something like Lempel-Ziv use the concept of entropy?
Well, they're all looking for patterns. Remember, low entropy means high predictability. It means some symbols, or importantly, some sequences of symbols, appear way more often than others.
Right.
Huffman coding, for instance, just gives shorter code words to the more common symbols. Lempel-Ziv, which is the basis for ZIP files, is even smarter. It looks for repetitive sequences. It basically says, hey, I've seen this phrase ABC before. Instead of sending those 3 symbols again, I'm just going to send a short pointer that says, go look at entry number 42 in the dictionary.
It replaces redundancy with a reference.
Exactly. By identifying and replacing that statistical redundancy, it drives the average rate, R, down toward that fundamental limit, H.
And Shannon didn't stop at lossless compression. He extended this whole idea to the messy world of lossy compression, which is how we stream video and audio.
Right, that's rate distortion theory, usually written as R of D. This is absolutely critical for all modern multimedia. It generalizes the source coding theorem by allowing for a specific tolerable amount of distortion, D, between the original and the final version.
So the theory defines the minimum data rate, R, that you need to achieve a certain level of quality, D.
Precisely. So when you're on YouTube and you change the video quality from 1080p to 480p, what you're really doing is adjusting D.
You're saying, I'm willing to accept more distortion.
You accept a higher D, and the theory tells you that allows the required transmission rate, R, to drop dramatically. And the really beautiful part is how it all connects back. If you set the tolerated distortion, D, to zero.
Meaning you want it to be perfect, lossless.
You want it perfect. Then the minimum required rate, R of zero, reverts precisely back to the source entropy, H. It's this beautiful, unified theory of data compression.
So, source coding is about making the data as efficient as possible before you send it. Now we need to pivot to the second, and maybe even more revolutionary, pillar, channel coding. This is about ensuring reliability during transmission over a noisy link.
This is the noisy channel coding theorem, or NCT, and it guarantees something that, at the time, seemed completely impossible. It is the guaranteed speed limit for reliable communication.
And the promise is that you can transmit information with perfect reliability, even over a noisy, corrupted channel.
As long as you stay under the speed limit. And that speed limit is called the channel capacity, C.
So you can effectively make errors disappear as long as you don't transmit faster than C.
That is the core guarantee. If your transmission rate, R, is less than the channel's capacity, C, then Shannon proved an encoding and decoding scheme must exist that can make the probability of error arbitrarily small, basically zero.
But the moment you try to go faster,
yeah,
if R is greater than C,
the whole thing collapses. The decoding must fail with a high probability. Your error rate skyrockets.
And the most famous practical application of this is the Shannon-Hartley theorem.
Right. The Shannon-Hartley theorem gives you the actual formula for the capacity, C, for a very specific but very common type of noisy channel, the additive white Gaussian noise channel, AWGN.
That's the background hiss you hear on a radio.
It's the model for all sorts of thermal and electronic noise. And the formula is C equals W times the log base 2 of 1 plus S over N.
S over N being the signal-to-noise ratio.
Right. And W is the bandwidth. This one formula defines the fundamental trade-off in all modern communication design. If you want to increase your speed, your capacity C, you have two levers to pull. You can either get more bandwidth, increase W, or you can boost your signal power relative to the noise, increase S over N.
So for something like a deep space probe, the signal is incredibly weak and the noise is high.
Very low S over N. So they have to compensate by using these enormous antennas and powerful transmitters to crank up the S part of that ratio as much as possible.
And conversely, for a fiber optic cable,
the bandwidth, W, is practically infinite. It's huge. So it can achieve enormous capacity, massive data rates, even with relatively moderate power levels. This formula tells engineers exactly what they get for their money. Spend $1 million on wider spectrum or spend it on a more powerful amplifier.
The most captivating explanation of why this theorem even works comes from its geometric proof. The sphere packing analogy. Can you walk us through that in detail? It's such a cool idea.
It's a fantastic way to visualize it. So imagine a very long message, say 1,000 bits. Shannon's insight was to stop thinking of it as a sequence of ones and zeros and instead picture it as a single point in a 1,000-dimensional space.
Okay, that's already a leap.
It is. Now, the total power you're allowed to use for your signal defines a very large sphere in this high-dimensional space. All the possible messages you can afford to send have to live inside this big sphere.
So the big sphere is your total signal power budget.
Correct. Now, noise gets added in the channel. So when you send your message, your single point, the receiver doesn't get that exact point. The noise turns that point into a fuzzy little sphere around the intended location.
So the received signal could be anywhere inside that little noise sphere.
Exactly. The receiver's job is to look at where the signal landed and guess which original message point is at the center of that noise sphere.
So for it to work without errors, the little noise spheres can't overlap.
That is the entire game. If the noise spheres for two different messages overlap, then the receiver can't tell them apart unambiguously. You get an error. So the channel capacity, C, is determined by a simple question. How many non-overlapping noise spheres can you pack inside the larger signal sphere?
And the arrangement of those spheres, the packing pattern, that's a code.
That is the code itself. Shannon calculated the ratio of the volume of the big signal sphere to the volume of one of the small noise spheres. That told him the maximum number of distinguishable messages he could send. Take the logarithm of that number and you get C, the capacity. It's this incredibly elegant proof based on pure geometry.
But as brilliant as it was, This proof created a huge problem for engineers, didn't it?
Oh, a massive problem. Because it was an existence theorem.
It proved the codes existed, but it didn't give you the recipe to actually build one.
Right. Shannon proved the speed limit was real and attainable, but the specific, incredibly complex, high-dimensional encoding and decoding algorithms you'd need for that perfect sphere packing, they were a complete mystery. And that set the agenda for coding theory for the next 50 years, this relentless quest to find a practical code that could actually get close to C.
And the reason for that 50-year delay between the theory in 1948 and actually deploying these codes in the 90s, it was mostly computational, not a lack of ideas.
It was almost entirely computational. To get close to capacity, you need codes with very long block lengths. You're encoding thousands of bits at a time. This translates into enormous complex calculations, and it requires these iterative decoding processes that just weren't feasible until we had powerful, cheap digital signal processors.
So what were the big breakthroughs that finally delivered on Shannon's promise?
The first huge one was turbo codes back in the early 1990s. They use this clever idea of iterative decoding, where you basically run the decoder multiple times, and the output of one decoder helps inform the input of the next. It's like two detectives sharing clues back and forth.
And they got incredibly close to the limit.
They were the first practical codes to operate within just a tiny fraction of a decibel of the Shannon limit. The other major class, which is everywhere now in your Wi-Fi and deep space probes, are low-density parity check codes, LDPC codes.
Which were actually invented way earlier.
Invented by Bob Gallagher at MIT in 1962, but they were so computationally intensive, nobody could build them until the 90s.
So how do researchers actually prove these codes work mathematically, beyond just running tests?
Well, a common way is to analyze their performance on a simplified, idealized channel. A good example is the binary erasure channel, the BEC. It's a great model for analysis because the noise is simple. A bit is either received perfectly correctly or it's completely erased. It just becomes a question mark. There's no flipping from a zero to a one.
Okay, so it simplifies the problem. And they use techniques like density evolution to track the decoding process.
Exactly. Density evolution is a way to mathematically track the probability of error at each step of the iterative decoding process. You can think of it as tracking how certain the decoder is about each bit. It starts with a weak guess, and in each step, it passes messages back and forth, and the certainty or belief gets stronger and stronger.
And the math shows it only works up to a certain point.
The math shows, with incredible precision, that for a given LDPC code, the beliefs will only converge to the right answer if the channel's erasure probability is below a specific critical threshold, a P star. If the channel is any noisier than that, the beliefs never converge and the message is lost. It's a beautiful mathematical confirmation that the limits Shannon predicted are real, hard, physical boundaries.
It's amazing how this abstract math became the literal grammar for engineering. But it goes so much further because it's fundamentally about quantifying uncertainty. And that takes it into completely different fields, like security.
Oh, absolutely. Information theory is just indispensable for modern cryptography. I mean, when we talk about randomness and security, what we're really talking about is entropy.
More uncertainty for the attacker.
Exactly. High entropy means greater uncertainty for an attacker, which translates directly to better security. If the process you use to generate a cryptographic key has low entropy, if it's too predictable, an attacker can guess the key with far, far fewer attempts than you think.
So information theory is what we use to design things like cryptographically secure pseudorandom number generators.
Absolutely. The math provides the tools and the metrics to test the output of these generators to make sure they are statistically indistinguishable from a truly random source. That is, to make sure the output sequence has maximal entropy.
And the concept of perfect secrecy also comes directly from information theory, right? Through the idea of mutual information.
Yes. Mutual information is a measure of how much information two variables share. For a crypto system to have perfect secrecy, Shannon proved that the mutual information between the original message, the plaintext, and the final encrypted message, the ciphertext, must be zero.
Meaning, if an attacker sees the encrypted message, they learn absolutely nothing about the original message.
Nothing at all. It's just as likely to be any possible message. And this principle also helps secure complex multi-stage systems.
Through something called a data processing inequality.
It's an incredibly powerful and intuitive idea. It basically guarantees that if you process information in a sequence of steps, like you encrypt a message, then you compress it, then you route it, no subsequent step can increase the amount of information you can learn about the original input.
You can't magically create information that wasn't there before.
Right. You can only lose it. Yeah. So if your first encryption step is solid, if it reduces the mutual information to zero, you can be sure that no amount of later compression or processing is going to accidentally leak that secret. It's a huge guarantee for system designers.
Okay, that's a huge relief. Now let's make a really radical jump. From global computer networks down to the molecular scale. Information processing inside living cells.
This is one of the most exciting frontiers for the theory. It's providing a common language for physicists, engineers, and now biologists. It's become a fundamental tool for quantifying information processing within cells.
Especially in how cells receive and react to signals.
Signal transduction, exactly. We can now treat a cell's signaling pathway as a communication channel. The cell membrane gets an input, like a growth factor molecule, and the nucleus produces an output, like activating a specific gene. The channel capacity, C, tells us the maximum rate at which that cell can reliably transmit information from its surface to its nucleus.
As you mentioned the Drosophila example.
Yeah.
The bicoid hunchback system.
I did. It's a classic case in developmental biology. There's a protein called bicoid that forms a concentration gradient in a developing fly embryo. The concentration of this protein, that's the input signal.
And that signal tells the embryo where to build its head and thorax.
Exactly. It dictates the expression pattern of another gene called hunchback, which is the output. Researchers were able to measure the mutual information between the bicoid concentration and the hunchback expression, and they found it was about 1.5 bits.
Okay.
But here's the amazing part. They also calculated the theoretical channel capacity of that physical system, and it came out to be around 1.7 bits.
Wow, so it's operating almost perfectly at the Shannon limit.
It's astonishingly close. It strongly suggests that biological systems have been optimized by evolution to be incredibly efficient information processors. They're pushing information through these noisy, messy channels almost as reliably as the laws of physics will allow.
But applying Shannon's pristine math to the messy reality of biology must have some serious practical challenges.
Oh, the hurdles are enormous. The biggest one is just data. To accurately calculate mutual information or entropy, you need to estimate these complex probability distributions. And to do that, you need massive sample sizes, which are often just impossible to get from biological experiments.
And as the systems get more complex with more genes and proteins, the problem gets exponentially worse.
Yes, the curse of dimensionality. A simple calculation becomes computationally intractable when you're dealing with high-dimensional omics data. Researchers have to use all sorts of clever statistical tricks to estimate these values without needing, you know, a billion samples. So there's always a trade-off between what's computationally feasible and how precise your estimate is.
And even if you get a number, say 2 bits of capacity, there's an interpretation gap, isn't there, between the technical number and the biological reality.
That's the crucial caveat. A capacity of 2 bits means, technically, that the pathway can reliably distinguish between 4 different input states. 2 to the power of 2. But the cell might only care about 2 biologically meaningful outcomes.
Like survive or die.
Exactly. The technical capacity might be higher than the actual functional need of the organism. So Shannon's measure is necessary, but it's probably not sufficient to give you the whole biological story.
Which brings us to the ultimate frontier, the one Shannon himself deliberately walled off, the problem of meaning, the semantic frontier.
Right. We're now moving beyond just the reliable transmission of ones and zeros and asking how those symbols actually relate to intent and goals. Shannon, you could say, solved level A, the technical problem of accurate transmission.
But semantic communication is about level B and level C.
Yes, this framework comes from Warren Weaver, who helped popularize Shannon's work. Level B is the semantic problem. Did the receiver interpret the message with the meaning the sender intended? And level C is the effectiveness problem. Did that meaning affect the recipient's actions in the desired way? Shannon gave us the math for level A, but B and C require totally different models.
And the sources give some great examples of how technical success can still be a semantic failure.
Yeah, take the simple case of a farmer telling his grandchild, the apple looks good, the sound waves are transmitted perfectly, level A is a success. But if the grandchild thinks he means his Apple phone, not the piece of fruit.
The meaning fails to transfer. Semantic failure.
Total semantic failure. And the reverse can also be true. You can have technical failure, but semantic success.
How does that work?
Well, say someone sends a message. The client does not like the proposal. But a small error in transmission makes it arrive as the client dislikes the proposal. Technically, the symbols are wrong. It's a failure. But the intended meaning got through perfectly. So semantically, it's a success. the receiver acts correctly.
And modern research is trying to push this into the realm of utility. How valuable is the information?
This goal-oriented metric is really the key. The idea is that information should be measured by how much it helps a recipient achieve a goal. And this brings in things like time. An instruction to turn left is incredibly valuable until you've already passed the intersection.
Then its value drops to zero.
Instantly. Its semantic utility is zero, even if the message itself was transmitted perfectly. The value of information is contextual and it decays.
This sounds a lot like what's happening in economics with the idea of rational inattention.
It's a direct application. This is work by the economist Christopher Sims. He basically applied the idea of channel capacity to human behavior. He argues that we as economic agents have a limited cognitive processing capacity, a mental channel capacity.
We can't pay attention to everything at once.
Impossible. You can't track every stock price, every inflation report, every change in interest rates. So Sim says we choose to be rationally inattentive.
It's rational to ignore most things.
It is, because the mental cost of constantly processing all that data outweighs the benefit you'd get from it. So people only choose to act on new economic information when it's significant enough to cross a certain threshold to justify the cognitive effort. He literally uses Shannon's channel capacity formula to model how much information a rational person chooses to absorb from a noisy economic environment.
It's taking Shannon's technical limit and turning it into a model for human behavioral limits.
Yes, it connects the abstract math of communication directly to how we manage complexity in our lives. Our brains don't have infinite bandwidth. We are constantly compressing and filtering the world around us.
So to wrap this all up, Claude Shannon performed this essential act of transformation. He took communication out of the world of physical engineering and put it into the abstract universal world of statistics. He gave us the grammar for quantifying uncertainty itself.
He did. And in doing so, he established these two fundamental, mathematically unbreakable laws that govern every piece of digital technology we use. First, the absolute floor for lossless compression, which is the entropy, R, must be greater than or equal to H.
And second, the absolute speed limit for reliable transmission over any channel, the capacity, R, must be less than C.
His work defined the very boundaries of the possible, and engineers spent the next 50 years building codes that could finally reach those limits. And with things like Turbo and LDPC codes, they finally did. They proved him right.
But as we've seen, this new frontier, the semantic frontier, trying to model meaning, opens up a whole new can of worms.
It's a completely different mathematical territory, because now you have to model human context and goals and interpretation, not just bits.
Which leaves us with a final, provocative thought for you to chew on. When researchers try to mathematically model these very complex semantic interactions, say, between two really smart people having a conversation, the math sometimes suggests a kind of logical inconsistency can emerge.
It's a fascinating idea. The theory suggests that two highly intelligent people might actually struggle to communicate efficiently because they would be constantly trying to infer the other's interpretation and then changing their own expression in response, which causes the other person to change their interpretation.
And you get stuck in this infinite self-referential loop.
You can. Shannon solved the technical problem with perfect mathematical elegance. But the act of actually conveying meaning introduces these new, messy, self-referential challenges that, in the end, might just reflect the inherent complexity and the occasional beautiful failure of being human.